I think we're going to get started again, folks, and offer the poets some questions. And we have a technical device. This is called a microphone. If you have a question, we ask you to use the microphone because it's for the recording. It doesn't amplify, but it's for the recording. So you have to speak it loudly enough that the people can hear you. Who has a question?
Sorry, what was your name again?
Erica.
Erica, so you said your first book was kind of about growing up. Was there...
Well...
like that was part of it?
So the first book in the trilogy. My first book was like 3 books ago.
So that's what I meant, sorry. The first book in that trilogy. And then was there some sort of thematic thing that you were exploring in your second book?
So the way that I look at it is Daryl Hall kind of glosses over things. It tries to keep things kind of light. It tells the stories, but it doesn't really go very deep into what's wrong or what's going on. It's just like kind of, you know, when you're a kid and you see things and then you remember them when you're older, you don't remember anything the same way. There's no accuracy. The things that you remember are basically built upon nostalgia. So in the second book in the trilogy, it's hard facts. It's the stories that I grew up hearing over and over and over about my family history. It goes from the Trail of Tears all the way to today. So it's very hard hitting. The whole middle section is like rapid fire. They're all very, very short lines, and it's like getting hit over and over and over with something. And I read from the last section of Daryl and from the last section of Mary. So I think it becomes clear, just even from listening to those two sections, that Mary is a little bit harsher in how it's treating things and situations and people.
Thanks.
Okay, so this is for Erica. The first part of the question is, so do you know who Harry Nielsen is? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, like, I absolutely love him, and I'm so inspired by him and his music. And for a long time, I've been trying to think of different ways that I could use his music in my writing. Like whether it's taking excerpts or like listening to something and creating your own story out of it. And I haven't really put enough time into doing that, but it's always been something that I really want to do. So what was your process like when you decided that you had been very inspired by these different, because you didn't only mention, you know, it wasn't only Hall & Oates, there were other, you know, Pink Floyd and Etta James. So like, how did you go about, like, was it a conscious decision to start focusing on the music and making poetry out of it?
Well, I'll tell you how the project started. It started out as a collaboration, kind of a call and response with another poet, Dan Thomas Glass, who's also here in the city, and he's fabulous. We both have this love for music, all kinds of music, and we would talk about music all the time, and trade music, and just we decided we should do something, you know, together that revolved around music. He was very into the dailiness of life, and by that I mean nothing spectacular happens and that's what's spectacular, and he's able to document it and, you know, talk about being a dad and his new role in the world. But he was listening to all of this music that sort of was like the soundtrack. So where I felt like I was writing sad poems all the time, and I wanted something to distract me from writing sad poems. So I got hooked on Hall & Oates. Daryl Hall has the web show live from Daryl's house. It's very, very different now than what it was. It was pure. Now it's all about selling Daryl Hall wine glasses. So I was watching all of those episodes and just sort of remembering that this was kind of like the soundtrack to a very specific time and place in my life. And I felt like I wasn't gonna write anything sad about it. Or they were sort of sad things, but there's also a lightness and nostalgia about it that wasn't gonna be sad, you know? So that's how it started. And then, so this is how I met Julia, because she wrote letters to Kelly Clarkson, and I just loved the writing. I loved what she was doing and her take on pop culture and her own life and experiences and melding it, because the book isn't about Kelly Clarkson at all. Well.
No, not in a conventional way.
Not, yeah. And so we started talking, because I was really, really hesitant to start doing the Daryl poems, like, in earnest. I'm doing this, and are people gonna get it? Because, I mean, what do? You laugh when you first hear the title. Daryl Hall is my boyfriend. So you know right off the bat, like, it's not gonna be super serious.
But I also remember us talking about how even a gimmick can mm-hmm. be really invested with, you know, lots of other stuff, like lots of other layers of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not just a joke.
Yeah. The joke just allows people to sort of, access it in their own way.
Yeah.
But yeah, none of the poems are about Hall & Oates. Not one. And the music that I mention, like Pink Floyd, I mean, and U2, and there's so many other references buried in there to other musicians or songs. I don't use Hall & Oates in there at all. Like, there's no direct reference to Hall & Oates or a Hall & Oates song. All of the music, all of the song references are outside of that. More than you wanted to know.
Solves the problem of the
title?
The
like, what
of
are you
going to
call it?
Yeah. Not the title of the book, but the title of the poems.
Oh, well, what I did was kind of, you know, when you hear things, you're not hearing them necessarily as they really are. Like, we all make up lyrics because we don't know the lyrics. So I would listen to, like, pieces in the songs and the lyrics and pick out what I liked or phrasing that I liked. And then I'd look it up on the internet and see what it really was.
Yeah.
And it's always like, oh, that's enlightening and sad that he's actually saying that. But so that helped, getting the right lyric and figuring out like how to cut them up. Like, there's no like straight lyric. Mm-hmm. It's cut up. Yeah, yeah.
Or there's a published lyric that isn't actually the lyric.
Yeah. Oh no, a lot of research went into Daryl Hall. I watched a lot of interviews with that man. A lot of Daryl Hall episodes. So.
Follow-up question, is it your kiss on my lips or your kiss on my list? for that song.
What do you think it is?
I have no idea. You're the expert here.
List. Kiss on my list. Can we sing it? No.
It seems there's a question in here about that's floating. I'm trying to think too about Julia's work as well, and this sense of, you know, how we're so afloat in and bombarded by whatever popular culture is. I mean, it's also the surroundings that are printed, that are, you know, that are in the air, that are, you know, that are not music per se, and so forth. But it's so much of a life of, say, Delano, and so forth, or of the valley, and it all has its, I don't know. I remember being young enough to cross the country, and places were radically different from one another, and now they're all marked rather similarly, at least through branding and so forth, and that. But it seems like your encounter with that place is so much a part of that book, and the ways of reading it, and all the surfaces, and that one has to read. I don't know, just this way in which, you know, popular culture, what is it, you know, in that sense?
Well, yeah, I often describe Letters to Kelly Clarkson as a book that's about pop music, but it's also more generally or more broadly about mass culture and about our emotional attachments to things that are very commercial and very corporatized and very fake. But we have like real feelings when we encounter them, and in the same way that Eric was describing the soundtrack, like we have these soundtracks to our lives that, and we don't even hear the lyrics correctly. So it's this like total lack of truth in a way, but true insofar as we have, you know, real affective experiences of them. And so Valley Fever, I think for me, continues that concern with mass culture in a sense. I mean, in one sense, you know, driving is a form of encountering mass culture. And you think about the ways in which the experience of driving is sold to us as something that's a really good idea, it's something that's really acceptable, it's something that we've defined as necessary in many ways. And when I was working on that book, I was also really influenced by Eileen Miles's book about commuting between San Diego and LA. And that book is another one that's thinking a lot about going back and forth on these crazy freeways and encountering and not encountering others, and kind of, you know, like literally following this path, this like weird asphalt trail, just because you're told to, and trying to have some kind of critical awareness of it at the same time that you're admitting that that's your experience, like that's your emotional landscape.
This is your life. Yeah.
What's that?
This is your life.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is a question for you, Julia. So, going to the musicality of the poems, in the Fur poems, your pauses felt like they were counted, mm-hmm. and it felt like a combination of stanzas, but also like musical pieces that interacted with each other. And you said something in the essay about the punctuation and working with in gem and ellipses, and can you say a little bit more about that? Because I found that really compelling as you were reading, and it interested me a lot, and I think it goes with the theme of music as well, because it's actually the musicality of the poetry that felt that way.
Well, I really like that you heard that as something that's musical, because it began as something that I thought of as visual. And I imagined this, so Letters to Kelly Clarkson is all prose poems, Valley Fever is all, I think it's all poems written in verse, with the new manuscript and going back to the prose poem and kind of reimagining its possibilities. And one of those possibilities was I wanted to know what would happen. I wanted to know how to enjam prose poems, basically, which is like a really boring thing for most people to think about, but I like to think about really boring poetry things. Like, how do you enjam a prose poem? And then I think it became kind of more meaningful and less boring when I thought about not just the visuality, but also the musicality, as you're pointing out. And so there's a lot of variability in how the poems have manifested. So sometimes the breaks have punctuation, sometimes they don't. Sometimes you could stitch them back together and it reads as a legible line, and sometimes it doesn't. It's a weird juxtaposition, or there's a jump or a leap. Some of them are quotations and some of them are not. So I kind of like the perversity of having no consistency there, but the consistency is like the formatting on the page. I'm using italics pretty consistently. And then, yeah, I think there is probably something kind of song-like about it, and modular. I mean, maybe you could say that anything modular, anytime you're working with something that's modular, you're thinking about the breath and you're thinking about rhythm. Even if the units aren't like all equal, you're thinking about how they work together and the temporality that goes into them. And then, of course, the whole manuscript is like obsessed with temporality and charting and the cycles of the moon and astrology. And so I like that. I like what you've just taught me about the manuscript, which is that the theme of temporality is also coming out in the form.
Hello. My question is almost the same question as the previous two questions, but slightly different, which is, and then lead up to mine. My question was about the lyrical and how you both embrace and then resist the lyrical, but more specifically, I think you maybe already spoke to this, Erica, but... because of the lyric and music, but I felt like, Julia, if I'm right, that you were wrestling with the lyrical also in the prose poems, like there was also a wrestling about femininity in the body that felt bound up in that same question. So I wondered if either of you wanted to talk about what it was like to write these books and wrestle with the lyric. Because you don't, there are the titles in Erica's book, right? But there's no lyrics, I don't think. Maybe there's some phrases or something in the body, but you don't want them there. You want them only in the title. So I wondered about the boundaries that you made within the books, et cetera. Thanks.
Well, I can say that Daryl had so many boundaries and so many rules. I mean, I was like, when I started thinking about the second one, I was just like, I'm never doing this to myself again. I mean, it's very, very, very...
You mean like the rules you set up for yourself for writing it?
The rules I set up for myself for writing it and how things had to work. And it was crazy making. I think we talked about it a little bit too. So I had just a whole bunch of boundaries that I had built into it, and dealing with the lyric was one of them. The way that I went about choosing the song titles, you don't necessarily have to know anything about Hall & Oates to read any of those poems, and you don't necessarily have to know like what's going on at the top with the title and then the bottom with the footnote. I didn't read the footnote because it's just the actual name of the song that the title is from. So it's the piece itself is just sort of encased between, I guess, between the song in a sense. But there's no mention of Hall & Oates' actual lyrics in any of the work, you know? It's like they're the framework, they're the structure. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the crazy boundaries I picked for myself.
Yeah. Anytime you pick those boundaries and you're like, shit.
Yeah. I'm like, this is, yeah, I gotta carry this all the way through for like three books.
Yeah. But. So yeah, as you know, I do think about the lyric a lot, and the manuscript that I'm working on now is definitely kind of interested in the problematic of reproductive futurity and how to think about that in a queer way, and also how bound up issues of temporality are with that kind of thinking and that conversation, you know, that's happening right now, especially in critical theory. And I'm sure there's another, it won't be my dissertation because I already wrote one, but I'm sure there's like another dissertation out there to be written about reproductive futurity and the lyric, going at least back to Shakespeare and Fair Creature's Desire Increase and all that. And if you think about how time is built into the sonnet and other forms of lyric, I'm sure someone's already written that dissertation, actually. And so, again, I guess what I'm thinking about in the poems themselves is how to kind of dwell inside that problematic and then figure out how to fuck with it, like, in interesting ways. So how to push back against really conservative, normative notions of futurity at the same time that, like, it can be really lovely to think about utopia and to think about possibility and to think about where temporality can lead us, especially from within a lyric form. That's like a really vague answer, I know, but it's like happening.
Maybe one last question somebody is dying to ask. You're dying to ask another one?
So this one's for Julia. my question is, with your poems, they felt as though they were de-romanticizing California. Like, I felt as though you were talking about how kind of, pardon my language, what shitty Sacramento is and the valley. I've been down to the valley before, and I felt as though you were hitting the nails on the head with it and kind of putting everything out there. So how'd you kind of go about doing all of that?
Yeah, well, I should say that I have like nothing but deep love for the Central Valley because that's where I grew up. And I just happened to also work in a pretty intense part of it where especially the air quality is like the worst in the country. And there's really intense stuff going on in that region. So I appreciate and probably agree with the idea that the poems are interested in de-romanticizing California. And I hope it comes through in Valley Fever, especially how much like abiding love there is for this place as well. And I think anytime you de-romanticize something, it's because you want to uncover what's good in that place, right? You want to bring light to what you want to critique or criticize, but it's also in the interest of reshaping what could possibly be made there. It's funny because your question makes me think about Letters to Kelly Clarkson and my longstanding fear that it would ever be read as a book that were mocking or criticizing Kelly Clarkson, and that was never my intention, and I hope it doesn't come out in those poems as well. Maybe the new figure for Valley Fever is California itself in that way. It's like a very loving critique in the environmental catastrophes that are happening in this state, and the really complicated relationship we have to home. And I mean, Erica talked about how complicated nostalgia is in that way. And like, here I am in my home state. I live 3,000 miles away now, but I have, my nostalgia is like formed by lots and lots of like weird angles and kind of odd, uncomfortable corners and lots of different kinds of feelings. Yeah.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks to you.